Hello, I'm Tom Ward, a partner in the tech sector team at Field Fisher, and welcome to this Field Fisher Automation Unwrapped podcast. In this series, my colleagues from across the tech sector team speak to their clients about the world of automation and what the future holds. In this episode, I speak to Svelin Rangelov, founder and CEO of Dronamix, the world's first cargo drone airline, on how Dronamix was founded and how it has grown to be Europe's first licensed cargo drone airline. We'll talk about how transport innovation is changing the way we live our lives and his predictions for the future. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Svelin, hi, it's great to talk to you this morning.
Hi, thank you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Svelin, when people hear the word drone, I'm sure they are thinking about small helicopter-like UAVs whizzing above the parks and our heads in cities. Dronamix is somewhat different. Tell us about the Black Swan, what it is and what it can do, and the journeys that it's currently making.
So we started a company 10 years ago, and at that time, the most commonly drones used to be the big military drones, a fixed wing looking like an airplane. And actually, Amazon just announced at the time that they'll be doing drone deliveries with small quadcopters, the small kind of drones that everyone is now familiar with. So we're building essentially an airplane that is civilian, that is for cargo. It just happens to have a cockpit on the ground instead of on board the airplane.
And tell us about the range. What kind of journeys is it looking to do?
Yeah, so we realized that existing aviation has a problem being too big. So you have very big airplanes flying between very big airports, and they get offloaded onto very big trucks. But that very big truck doesn't ring your doorbell. There's an additional handover to a small courier van. So we said, if there's only going to be packages on board, then there's not going to be humans, there's not going to be a cockpit. You can size the vehicle as much or as little as you want. And so we decided that it should carry exactly what you can fit in the back of a last mile courier van. So around 350 kilograms is our payload. And we wanted to make sure that it can fly long distances. It can cover all of Europe in one flight. So about 2,500 kilometers is the max range. It's also the midpoint of the US, South China Sea, diagonal, Caribbean, and so on. So it's just a great regional solution to unlock same day delivery for less connected communities.
And so Dronamix isn't just building and manufacturing the drone, but it's creating these kind of drone ports across those journeys to do fulfillment. Tell us a little about the network that you've created so far.
Yeah, we realized because it's new technology, if a customer buys a truck, they can fix it in any village. But if it's a new airplane, it just creates complexity. And ultimately, they don't want to be buying airplanes. They want to be buying capacity being delivered at the lowest cost and the shortest time. So we realized we need to be not just inventing, but also building the aircraft and deploying it and operating it as an airline. So we have to really be building a network. So on the way it works is in every village, every city, every town, we'll have a drone port, essentially a runway. That's a short runway, 400 meters. So it's anywhere you can land with two-seater aircraft, we can land there. But you need a ground control station, essentially the cockpit on the ground. That's, again, a low-cost solution. You have a couple of trained pilots that do the takeoffs and landings. And that drone port is your gateway to your community. And now it can connect to all the other communities in your country or in all the other countries where we'll be present. So we're starting in Greece this year with commercial operations. And then we'll move into different countries in the EU. We'll do a demonstration flight in the UK under the Future Flight Challenge. And similarly, there's other markets in the Middle East, UAE, Saudi, as well as in Asia and Australia that we'll be unlocking. In a few years' time, we should be present in every single country, and then the real network effects could be really appreciated.
What are the environmental benefits, Svelin, of the kind of Dronamix system versus old cargo airline journeys?
So first, being small means that you can land on a small runway. That means you can land on 10 or 20 times more places than you can land with existing aviation. It also means because you don't carry the crew with you, the crew stays in the city, you can send direct shipments. And because you're small, it's much easier to activate a route on a point-to-point basis, which means you first cross less kilometers, you spend less energy moving atoms over a shorter distance. But also our design, we didn't take an existing airplane because existing airplanes were always designed for humans first. So we decided to completely design it from scratch with one mission to carry boxes. And as a result, we have a very fuel efficient airframe. So even if we were to use gasoline, we would already be achieving up to 60% savings when it comes to emissions for the movement of cargo we do. But we're also working with SAF, sustainable fuels, biofuels, as well as on a couple of hydrogen projects. We can definitely get to zero emission transportation with this platform.
Excellent. And I want to talk about a specific journey in particular, and yours and your brother Konstantin's journey of building Dynamics into what is now the world's first cargo airline and Europe's first licensed cargo airline. So right at the start, from the initial idea all the way through to shaving your beards last year, tell us a little bit about that. How did you both come up with the idea?
My brother studied aerospace engineering in the Netherlands, and I had already come back to Bulgaria at the time. And one time we were chatting and he told me, "When are you coming to visit me now?" And I said, "I don't have any plans for that." "Why?" I'm missing Bulgarian cheese, this feta like cheese that we have. And so I got a little annoyed. I was like, "You're the engineer, figure it out, build a drone and I'll send it to you." And that's what pointed us into the direction of building this middle mile solution, because a small drone cannot fly 2,000 kilometers to the Netherlands with a kilo of cheese. So you need to make a bigger drone. And then if you make a bigger drone, then you can carry more cargo and so on. And then you realize it's not the last mile that's the challenge, it's the middle mile. When we pitched the idea to a local accelerator, they gave us a green light, they gave us funding. And when we got their first funding, we said, "He's not going to shave until we build the first full-size aircraft and until the first flight." And I said, "Great, I hate beards too, so let's be miserable together until we do that." And then we never expected it to take 8.5 years to shave, but it did. So last year, we finally had our maiden flight. We proved the technology. We're very happy. Again, clean sheet design, a lot of novel things, and we had to shave. Funnily enough, our wives actually met us after we had beards, so we had to grow the beards back.
Brilliant. So tell us a little bit about some of those obstacles along the way. So as you say, 8.5 years through to that first successful flight, design, manufacture, building and scaling a team, putting governance in place. What are the particular challenges that you faced? What advice would you give to someone else trying to build an innovative transport kind of business? What obstacles will they likely face along the way as well?
So he studied aerospace engineering, but I studied economics and always being curious about business. When we went into this, we went with a very long-term mindset. It's almost, if you look at any successful person, it took them decades to get there, right? Never an overnight success. So we came prepared, and especially aviation timelines, iteration takes longer, takes a lot of capital and so on. We could have certainly done that in less than 10 years if we had more capital earlier. But looking back, also the regulations in Europe only came on year 7 of our business. So even if we had been ready, and we would have just eaten a lot of capital for nothing. And a lot of drone businesses went out of business along the way because of the timing mismatch. So we built a business out of Bulgaria, where it's home and where we know we can have the most control over costs. But that also put us a little bit off the beaten path. So getting the capital we need was always a big challenge. But on the other hand, it forced us into that discipline that we need to really make sure that we're very cost conscious in what components we use and so on. Because it's very easy to just buy off the shelf things that cost 6-digit, 7-digit, and then you end up with multi-million-dollar vehicle. But the world doesn't need multi-million-dollar airplanes of that size because the model won't work. The cost per mile would be too expensive. So it could have gone a different way, but I'm not sure it would have gone a better way had some of these things been different.
How have you had to adapt to the evolving regulation? So you mentioned that it just wasn't ready for the first wave of drone companies. It is there now. Is it fit for purpose? How do you see regulation either still being an obstacle or evolving with you?
It's actually very interesting because the EU regulations are largely a product of this, you know, 63 countries working on them for 15 years. The EU played a big role in crafting them, and then felt comfortable enough and had the willingness to implement them first. EU is typically considered to be slow and so on, but actually this is a great narrative violation for drones. They went, they're much ahead of anyone. So when they implemented those regulations, they changed what was previously a very impractical patchwork where you used to only be looked at how much you weigh. So the more you weigh, the more risky you are. It didn't reflect reality because you may be very big or heavy, but if you're flying over water or like over far fields, the risk in practice is much lower. Similarly, you may be very small and light, but if you're flying over a busy pedestrian street or a stadium on a Taylor Swift concert, you can cause a lot of trouble. So the EU regulations reflected that. And interestingly enough, they actually favor us a lot more than pretty much anyone else, because finally we got credit for all these design decisions that we took, because we purposefully went after a fixed wing shape because it's more commonly understood. We went with an existing certified engine because we wanted to reduce the technical risk there as well. And we fly between cities, not inside of them. We fly from existing airfields. We fly in controlled airspace. So we're just like another airline. We have transponders and so on. So these rules actually give us credit for all of this and put us ahead of everyone. So we were either lucky or very smart to make those decisions 10 years ago or both. But that's why we are where we are. We're ready to launch commercial service and others are years behind.
And I note as well that earlier this month, you were selected as one of 15 CEOs as part of the EU Future Mobility Task Force, which is a strategic initiative to advise the EU's leadership in global transport innovation. So firstly, well done. That's a great achievement to be part of such a select group. Tell us a little bit about how you see your role in that group and the future of autonomous and UAV transportation across Europe.
Europe has always been a transportation leader, right? So there's not many places around the world that have the type of infrastructure Europe has been able to build over the years. Having said that, over the past couple of decades, things have moved at a much slower pace, right? You have China building 20,000 kilometers of high-speed rail. I'm not sure Europe gets anywhere near a number that's even maybe two orders of magnitude lower than that. So this task force is a way to help Europe come back ahead in a sector that's so critical because technology is moving ahead very quickly. It's among those 15, 16 companies we're on the task force. There's a few of us on the aviation side, but there's also city public transportation. There's personal mobility. There's all kinds of things that we as consumers use in our daily lives. And the advancement of this technology done the right way and not being necessarily blocked by incumbents or some rules that are no longer adequate, that advancement is what's going to determine the quality of life we can have. So that's why it's important for those voices to be heard, because just technology moves a lot faster than regulation. That's always been going on.
And tell us a little bit about the EIC kind of funding that is available for companies out there in this space. Part of the EIC commitment is to fund a 10 billion euro budget to transport entrepreneurs, a lot of which the innovation will be around autonomous vehicles for sure. Just tell us a little bit about that EIT urban mobility program and the EIC funding.
Yeah, so we are one of the proud recipients of funding from the European Innovation Council Accelerator program, where we're a recipient of 2.5 million euros in the form of grants and another up to 10 million in the form of investment. It's the first time the EU has done direct investment this way. They used to just give grants, but then the EU taxpayers would miss out on the opportunity of the upside for those technologies that actually survived the grant phase. So it's been a good journey having them involved. I think the EU should definitely double down and do a lot more because, yes, there's talk about EU sovereign wealth fund that focuses on technology. That's a great initiative. I think there's also a lot of untapped potential when it comes to, let's say, pension funds. There's every country has its own pension fund regulation, but pension funds are among the largest LPs in US venture capital. So that's a lot of latent source of capital that could fund innovation in the EU, UK, and elsewhere. So there are levers to influence and say, okay, maybe a tiny small percentage of your portfolio needs to be invested either in venture funds or directly in some companies that have gotten the sort of like the seal of approval, like going through the EIC. You need to pass quite a high bar. And so there's mechanisms that they can unlock some of that dormant capital, because ultimately Europe is getting older. My generation, we're looking at retirement ages of 80 plus. If you want the current math to stay, So the only way for that to kind of change is for these portfolios to grow, and alternatives is just one of the very few paths that this could happen in, generate outsized returns compared to the market. This is just one potential solution, but Europe, as any other developed country, is facing a lot of hard decisions ahead if it wants to maintain the quality of life, increase the quality of life, and protect its way of life.
Certainly with that available funding out there and with innovators such as yourself, I think the future looks bright. One final question, Spieglen, and you touched upon this earlier. I see that you have regrown a beard. It's not quite as fulsome and brilliant as the one pre-2023, but is there any plan with your brother again to shave these off at the next kind of milestone event? And what would that be?
No, there's no more plan. Like I said, our home has convinced us. So yeah, we'll just keep the beards, but at least in a more controlled way than 8-year outgrowth that we saw. So yeah, in terms of next milestones, we're certainly looking forward to launching commercial flights in Greece later this year. We're also working on a joint venture for a mass manufacturing facility in the UAE, which will be able to build up to 300 drones for the Middle East and global markets. We'll be looking to set up similar factories in other countries, other regions around the world. Yeah, this year, a lot of exciting things are planned ahead. Quite looking forward to that.
We wish you all the best. And thank you for joining us. And thank you for everyone else for joining this episode of Phil Fisher's Automation Unwrapped podcast. If you have any questions about today's update, don't hesitate to reach out to us. If you found it useful, do make sure to give us a like or review on your podcatcher of choice. We'll see you next week.